got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, How Just is Canada's Justice System? Our panel featured poet and activist Elle Jones and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter Carl Nierenberg. Here is a small clip from this week's panel. Take a listen.
So to kick off our conversation, I'm going to pass it over to Libby.
Okay. Thanks very much, Robin. Well, as you've noted, this month on our panel, we asked the question, how just is Canada's justice system? Who is it serving and protecting, and who gets left behind? Does our justice system fully respect everyone's rights and freedoms? Well, from the ongoing federal Black Class Action lawsuit alleging systemic and anti-Black racism in the federal public service, to a history of policing and silencing of Palestinian voices and more, clearly we can tell that something isn't working. So to start us off today, we're going to begin with you, Carl. We're going to go to Elle. And actually reference your book from 2022, Abolitionist Intimacies, where you took readers behind the bars and shared with them the many human rights violations which exist inside Canadian prisons. So just to put to you, what has changed in the last 2 years, if anything?
Yeah, and I mean, I hate to start with talking about America on a Canadian panel, but I think it is significant that we just came through an election where everybody seamlessly talked about, oh, isn't it wonderful that we have a prosecutor running against a convicted felon? And so convicted felon was kicked around as though we were supposed to see people who have been convicted of felonies as lesser. And that struck me as not to like stand up for Trump or anything, but to say that when we use that kind of discourse, it was interesting to me that now 4 years removed from 2020, when we were having these conversations about defunding the police and abolition, that we could all now basically hold up prosecution and felonies as worth judgments of people's worth, I think says something about the kind of backlash we are experiencing now. So of course, in 2020, words like defunding the police became mainstream. And when those concepts were explained and given to the Canadian public, majorities of people supported them. So people have understood that, for example, calling the police to deal with wellness checks or, you know, mental health crises is not only inappropriate, but deathly. So over 50% of police shootings are, of course, people in mental health crisis. There was a lot of discourse on police deaths involving Indigenous people and the long history of police violence. And, of course, police killings of Black people. Many people don't realize that we've had multiple most deadly years of police since then. And in fact, what the news reported was the deadliest year for police officers, ignoring the fact that police killings were also way up, I believe, in 2023. In a sort of 2 week period this year in September, we had like half a dozen deaths of Indigenous people back to back to back, and it received very little attention. So I say all of this to say that the system hasn't changed at all, and in many ways it's got worse, but we are now in a time where in a backlash where people believe the mythology that police have been defunded when in fact they were never defunded and receiving stratospheric budgets more than ever. There was recently a report that the London police hired a PR navigation, like the navigator, that firm that everybody hires like when they get in PR trouble, to basically create disinformation in the public around crime in order to ram through an unprecedented budget. As you mentioned with Palestine, the police have really capitalized off that and the policing of pro-Palestinian protests in order to get huge budgets around hate crimes. And we recently saw the ridiculous raid that took place in BC against Samadoun, which used, you know, multiple SWAT teams in order to enter this home. And this is really indicative of the kind of discourse on policing and budgeting of policing. The last thing I'll say is inside prisons ever since COVID, this has been happening for a long time, that prisons have been securitizing gradually, partly because of low staff. They cannot replace their staff. When I first started doing prison work over a decade ago, people were out 8 hours a day. Now you're lucky if they're out half an hour a day. often they're locked up days on end. They can't get showers. They can't get to the phone. There's no access to education and programming. Community is very unlikely and limited to get in. People often can't even access their lawyers. There's high rates of violence, high rates of disease, high rates of mental health. Even though we claim to have abolished solitary confinement, we've in fact replaced it with something which is worse, which is behavioral units or what they call structured integration units, which are a worse form of solitary that are not monitored. So in almost every indication I can think of, from the actual conditions to the use of segregation, the conditions are far worse and have become and are always accepted. So I've seen this incremental slide with just people now accept a complete lack of program, not leaving your cell, not getting showers, not getting phone calls, not getting visitors as normal under the guise of securitizing the prison. So I think prison-wise, things are worse. Policing-wise, budgets are up and things are worse. And we're in a time, I think, of unprecedented backlash. And part of this global right-wing reaction is to really invest even more in policing and authoritarian narratives.
Elle, I learned a new word tonight, securitizing. I thought, okay, what does she mean? But then, of course, you explained it. So that's actually very disturbing to hear, because I would say that, you know, in the Canadian public perception, generally, people would think, oh, well, Canadian prisons, incarceration, it's not that bad relative to certainly the U.S. or many other places. So it's very interesting to hear you describe this increasing securitization. What is your sense of the public? Is there much public awareness about what's going on in prisons? Is there much, do we have reports that tell us what's going on? And how publicly available or accessible are those reports?
Yeah, we have endless reports. So, of course, we have the Office of the Correctional Investigator, mm-hmm. which recently released their first report on people doing life sentences. Every year they do a report on Indigenous people in prisons. And, of course, people may not know that over 50% now of federal prisons incarcerated in women's prisons are Indigenous women, more than 50%, and over 30% in prisons for men. High rates of dangerous offenders, unfairly, lack of access to parole. There was recently a Black Justice Strategy released, which also goes over those conditions and lack of access to justice for Black people in Canada. There's Elizabeth Fry Society and others have done multiple reports on the conditions for women. So there's report after report after report after report. Prisons are very difficult to access. People who talk to the news find themselves having their phones cut. They're often transferred. There's retaliation. I'm banned from the prison. I'm not allowed to go in. That's very, very common. Back to Claire Culhane, the MP who got letters from prisoners in the 70s and wrote the book Banned from Prison in like 1981. So this is a long-standing problem in Canada. Prisons are not visible. And so people have mythologies about prisons that they learn from they learn from crime shows and from fiction, and they don't have a real understanding of who's in prisons, which is, of course, largely people convicted of nonviolent crimes, crimes of poverty, people with disabilities, and people experiencing mental health crises. They don't understand that now 80% of people on remand who have not, in other words, 80% of the provincial jail is now people on remand who have not actually been convicted. That number used to be 2/3, now it's on any one day close to 80%. So I could go on and on, but I know then I'd be here all night. But just to say that Canadians believe that the problems with prisons belong to the US and that we have a kind of gentler system, but that's not in fact the case. We have the same disproportionate racialized incarceration. We have terrible conditions and we have increasing sentences and punishment as well.
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. Would you note any difference between federal institutions and provincial correctional centers?
Yeah, often people say provincial is worse because it's intended to be short. So federal is, of course, everything over 2 years. So at least there's some sense of, like, and I hate to say this about a prison because obviously I don't believe that prisons are ever a humane place. But you at least, you know, have a fridge and you can cook your own food in a federal prison, something you don't have access to really in a provincial prison. So the last meal comes around at 4 p.m. in a provincial prison, often for dinner, and people don't have access. The dirt, like the lack of cleaning, like the mold, the mice infestations. This is true of all prisons, but particularly in provincial, because of how many people are in and out. There's people on remand, there's people doing weekends, there's people coming in for the night. So at least a federal prison has a, you can establish things more. You get clothes, you get things that you don't get in provincial. So people don't pay a lot of attention to provincial prison. But for example, East Coast Prison Justice does an annual report on the conditions in provincial prisons. And I urge people to read ours. I think it just came out in October. So if you're interested, at least in the conditions in Nova Scotia prisons, look for East Coast Prison Justice Society and you can read those kind of conditions.
Mm-hmm. And just one, I mean, I think this is quite illuminating probably for a lot of people. So just one other question. Are Indigenous programs within prisons based on Indigenous practice still being sustained, or have we seen that sort of eroding?
No, they have them in a sort of disturbing way because many people only get access to Indigenous culture within a prison. So we don't often provide it for people until prison. It's by self-identity. So there's questions about sometimes non-Indigenous people access healing lodges in prisons. But it will also, so there is elders, for example, and they attend parole hearings. There is separate Indigenous units in some prisons, but also, I know people who have been banned from smudging because they're in maximum security and they won't give them the materials, or they're not allowed to go down to the sweat lodge because they're not on the correct discipline level. So they would never deny a Bible to a Christian prisoner, but will deny access to Indigenous ceremony for Indigenous prisoners. That's very common. And then, yeah, I mean, no matter what. So even though, like, you know, there was a story that they're going to build a new prison, like in the shape of a Thunderbird, rather than just decarcerating Indigenous people. I saw this story that they're actually selling CSC, like Correctional Services is selling Indigenous crafts made by incarcerated Indigenous people as authentic Indigenous crafts. So this is the kind of like perverse world we live in, where we incarcerate like 50% of the prisoners Indigenous women, and then like, but we taught them beading, as though that's some kind of cultural solution. So many people have called the prison the new residential school, to recognize that just as residential schools took people from the land, divided families, committed trauma and violence, the prison is forming the exact same function for us today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks. I mean, I think that is very illuminating. And I hope that your book from 2022, that maybe you updated or there's a new version coming out, because you obviously have an incredible amount of information to share. I think we're still missing a Chuka at this point, so maybe I'll just move on to Carl.
Before you do that, I want to just follow up with a couple of things that Elle said, because so Elle, you mentioned, you brought up, of course, increases to police budgets and the, you know, the way police deal with people in having mental health crises. So just a couple of things here from Ottawa. So it's budget time here in Ottawa, and sure enough, the Ottawa police are asking for another multi-million dollar budget increase, which they will definitely get, despite the fact that their own data shows that they are still using force disproportionately on Black and Middle Eastern people, and the fact that they just put out their study on their 10 years of race-based traffic stop data, which they were forced to start collecting. And not only does it show that things haven't gotten better, they've gotten worse over the 10-year period, but they're still gonna get the big money. And then in terms of people in mental health crisis, so we have now the coroner's inquest into the death of Abdirahman Abdi in 2016, who was having a mental health crisis, and the police were called, and he ended up dead. And this, again, this is 2016. So here's an issue we have. This is happening 8 years after his death, this inquest. Right? And the officer who was involved in that was acquitted in 2020. So, all right. Yes, let's go to Carl. Carl, in 2019, you published an article on Unravel titled Canada has a long history of ignoring reports like the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls report. Do you see any similarities with the many reports that have been done related to the justice system?
In the case of the justice system, I mean, we've had the many reports from the correctional investigator, and I do urge people to have a look at the correctional, and go to the website of the correctional investigator and go way back, a decade to more than a decade ago. But in the case of Indigenous people, there have been many, in that particular article you cite, which is 5 years old, I cited the recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. And the recommendations were more broad-based in terms of similar to the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They were broad-based and based on Indigenous governance, Indigenous self-government, Indigenous rights. And I cited the many, many documents going back to the 1980s that I have been aware of, even going back to the 1970s. If you go back to something called the Berger Report, which was notionally about building a pipeline in the Northwest Territories and covered broader territory, and how, and all the constitutional processes for Indigenous people, and how all of this had been exercised, huge and enormous exercises in futility, and that you have a class of people in Ottawa who are have primary responsibility for Indigenous people, who have learned to talk a certain rhetoric of recognition of rights and recognition of indigeneity and recognition of First Nations peoples as peoples, but who are privately profoundly cynical about the whole process and treat it as a question of dealing with elites on the Indigenous side and dealing with their own elite position. And, you know, we had reports on self-government. You had the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. You had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which our current Prime Minister foolishly and in an effort just to virtue signal said, we will fulfill every single one of the reports in the time between the reports publication of the time in which he said that, it was inhuman, not humanly possible to even have read it. He promised to fulfill all the recommendations before he actually read them. And of course, they haven't bothered to do that. Similar, the time I wrote that article, the report on violence toward Indigenous women and girls had just come out, and I expected similarly that it would gather dust and it would be ignored. I don't think the Highway of Tears in British Columbia, where so much tragedy and so much violence occurred, has particularly changed, or that the relationship of Indigenous communities to the police has particularly changed, especially, not just in outlying areas, but especially in areas where Indigenous people are the majority. So the police in the North and mid-North, where the Indigenous people are the majority of the population, where we're on their territory, literally, the police forces act as more an army of occupation than a police force is there to protect people, help people, and take care of their needs. So I guess in terms of, that's just one group we're talking about in terms of Indigenous people, but I know that I've been looking at reports of the Corrections Commissioner going back to the time when I started writing for Rabble, and Howard Sapers, some people may remember, was the totally ignored Corrections Commissioner who Stephen Harper finally got rid of. But similarly, just this year's, the most recent, maybe it's not the 22-23 report, actually chooses to micro-focus on one issue that's worth, that you'd never think of. It says prisoners are supposed to be paid something for the work they do, and they're supposed to get a certain amount of money so that they can buy food and buy things that they need, and that their pay is stuck in a different era. It's stuck, it is pay based on our concept of what they needed 40 to 50 years ago, and it's virtually not changed. They have a long chapter on that particular issue, and I really recommend people read it. They also touch on what Elle talked about, how it doesn't do any good to change the name of solitary confinement, but to continue to practice it. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I think it's a bit, given the current government, unlike the previous government, they were hostile to human rights, hostile to people who found themselves in difficulty with the justice system. This government is full of, has been from the beginning, from 2015, a prime minister who is in love with symbolism and rhetoric and posing, and that's really all that we have gotten from this government rather than action.
Yeah, and just before we go back to Elle to get a response, I did want to say, Carl, that I went and reread your article from 2019 on the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. I mean, that's 5 years ago, and it was actually quite incredible to read. I imagine Brianne will post it in the chat, but when reading your article, it is just incredible to see how you go back, and this is one thing that you're just terrific at, is remembering history, the record of all of these reports that just go, I mean, I remember the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in 1996 that you reference in your 29 article, but you go back, you know, even before that, you mention other reports that have come since 1996. I'm glad that Rabble, you know, keeps track of this stuff and there's somebody, you know, monitoring what's going on. But to throw this back to Elle now, and you know, sort of looking at the more legislative side, so we have the practice of what's going on in terms of incarceration and the inequities and the disproportionate incarceration of people of color, of Black people, of Indigenous people. But on the legislative side, I mean, it seems like Canada, you know, we have this reputation of being a land of reports. We love producing reports and commissions and inquiries, but our record of actually following them up is pretty pathetic. So I just wonder if you have any further comments on that, just following up from Carl's comments.
Yeah, well, in my book, I call that the violence of the paperwork.
So there you go.
Bureaucratic violence that is often done in Canada, either by not keeping records, by overkeeping records, by losing the records, by doing reports. I wanted to say in terms of, I'm going to hold up this book. You saw me spin around and get it. Solidarity Behind Bars by Asif Rashid and Jordan House is the first book in Canada to look into prison unionizing and prison labor.
Was a small clip from Rabble's most recent Off the Hill political panel. We'll have the entire panel up on Rabble TV and Rabble's YouTube channel next week. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in world news. On Thursday, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. The court found that it was reasonably possible that Netanyahu and Gallant are culpable for war crimes related to the attack against the Palestinian people, which has been ongoing since the October 7, 2023 attack by Hamas against Israeli civilians. The court found that Netanyahu and Gallant were not working to ensure access to the necessities of life for Palestinian civilians, and as a result may be culpable for murder. An arrest warrant was also issued for Hamas leader Mohammed Diab Ibrahim al-Masri, also known as Dief, for the attack against Israeli civilians on October 7th of last year. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said that Canada would abide by the rulings of the International Criminal Court. Staying in world news, the G20 summit has wrapped up this week in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The summit, which saw 19 of the world's richest countries meet and discuss global issues, dealt primarily with the problem of income inequality. Countries in attendance issued a commitment to raise taxes on the super rich to help shrink the income gap between the very rich and the very poor. Also agreed to at the summit was the Global Alliance Against Hunger, which aims to end extreme poverty and hunger through things like wage transfers and paid-for school meal programs. In labor news, sex worker rights organizations are arguing that the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act is unconstitutional. The act is purportedly aimed at protecting sex workers by criminalizing those who would pay for or profit off of their work. The Supporting Women's Alternatives Network and the BC Civil Liberties Association, however, both say that the act instead criminalizes sex work and puts sex workers in harm's way. It does this by criminalizing the work of those who support sex workers, whether it be clients, receptionists, drivers, or security employees. In 2019, the BC-based union Move Up was the first union to declare its support for the decriminalization of sex work. They continue to support sex workers, writing on their website, quote, "Sex work is work. Sex workers want rights, not rescue." End quote. In Ontario news, the province plans to close many of its supervised drug consumption sites early next year. However, the province's own research does not support that decision. An internal review conducted by the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care found no correlation between supervised consumption sites and a rise in local crime around those facilities. The review did find that there was a correlation with decreased drug-related mortality rates. According to the review, neighborhoods in Toronto with supervised consumption services experienced a 67% reduction in overdose-related deaths. There were 265 drug-related deaths in Ontario in October of this year. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is saying that even despite Donald Trump's re-election as U.S. president, there is still cause to be hopeful that the fight against the climate crisis will continue. He pointed out that the Biden administration has taken major steps in the U.S. to make the economy greener. His government's $80 billion investment in the green economy has created thousands of jobs in many states that voted for Donald Trump. Suzuki said that it would be hard for Trump to roll back many of these popular initiatives. Even in a deeply Republican state like Texas, investment in renewable energy is 70 times higher than it was 10 years ago, and ownership of electric vehicles is 40 times higher. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to hear Rabble Radio on your local community or campus radio? It's easy. To learn more, get in touch with us today at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.